I'm Rachel Newton.
And I'm Lauren McCall. Welcome to the Heal and Harrow podcast.
The 16th and 17th century Scottish witch trials were one of the darkest periods of Scotland's history. An estimated 2,500 people, mostly women, were executed and many more accused. With Heal and Harrow, we seek to pay a humanising tribute to these women while also exploring historical beliefs in the supernatural and modern-day parallels in our society today.
Our project takes the form of an album and a live show. The music is based on specially commissioned works by celebrated author Mary Kidd, tales inspired by and in remembrance of real women who were persecuted and tried as witches, and characters from the folkloric tales and mythology enshrined in our oral culture. These stories form part of her brilliant book, We Are All Witches.
In this podcast, we discuss the women who inspired the work, Mary's writing process, and how we went about creating our musical response. We'll also hear excerpts from the stories themselves, read by 10 brilliant women from across Scotland.
Do click the subscribe button to make sure you catch each episode as soon as it's released. And if you would like to rate and review, that would be much appreciated as it really helps us reach more ears. You can find links to purchase our album, Mary's book, and download the story readings in full at healandharrow.com.
This week's episode is Lilias, read by award-winning writer, actor, director and singer-songwriter Gerda Stevenson. Here's Mary to tell us more about Lilias. So this is actually the first time that we have been in the same room, in the same breathing space as Mary, since before we started this project. It's so lovely to see you, Mary.
Oh, it's lovely to see you guys. I think it was a lockdown project initially, wasn't it? And so it's one of the odder experiences I think we've all had of collaboration, but it does show what amazing things you can do with Zoom.
Yeah, but it is very lovely not to be looking at you on a small screen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's great to finally get the chance to actually talk about your process and about our process and how the whole project came together, I guess.
Absolutely.
And of course, we're starting this week with track number one on our album. We're going to talk about Lilias today. Would you mind giving us a sort of overview of Lilias?
Of course. Lilias AD was accused of witchcraft. She wasn't actually ever convicted of it, but she was accused of witchcraft in 1704. So she's one of the later sort of sets of accusations. Witchcraft persecution went in waves. We call them sometimes the witch panics. So Lilias is quite a late example. She was from Torryburn in Fife, and there was a bit of an enthusiast there in the local minister for the discovery of witches. And so Lilias was taken up and she was interrogated. But she's unique in terms of the history of Scotland's witches because she was never tried. She died before she could be brought to trial. We, of course, don't know if she died through torture, if she died through just the duress, the difficulty of that situation, or simply old age and ill health, or, you know, a combination of all of those. But that left the authorities with a bit of a difficult decision, because usually witches were strangled and they were burned. They weren't burned alive in most cases. They were strangled. That was a small mercy. And then they were burned, so the body no longer existed. There was no disposal of a body. So the authorities had the body of a known witch on their hands. So what were they to do with it? And they came up with a sort of quite an unusual, I suppose, solution, which was to bury Lilias in the intertidal area in Torryburn Bay. So her grave is only visible at low tide. It's, I suppose you could call it, a liminal space. She's neither on land nor in the sea. And the grave was weighed down by an enormous slab of sandstone. The idea that were in many places traditions of where witches were buried, of burying them face down under stones. The idea being that, you know, they can't rise again to do the devil's work. So that's where Lilias's body ended up. The grave is there and the slab is there today, but her body isn't. It was dug up by, I don't know how you would describe them, treasure hunters, ghouls, amateur archaeologists. and it was still doing the rounds, shall we say. The skull was exhibited as late as the 1930s, but it's now lost and the rest of the body is lost. We don't know where it is, but there is a photograph, and with that photograph, her face has been reconstructed by a team of forensic experts. So she's extremely unusual. We can look her almost in the eye, and of course we can see that, what was she? She was a normal woman.
The museum. It is not a large museum, but it was founded by a philanthropist in the Victorian era, and in common with many other institutions of its vintage, the River Lee holds in its collection objects that are sensitive in nature. Some are items sacred to other people and places, amulets, clothing or weaponry that may not be sold or given. These carry within their very fabric a way of looking at the world, a stock of belief and belonging, an echo of a language or a song. Donated to the River Lee by colonial administrators, army officers or missionaries, it is impossible to say whether any individual item was stolen, looted, or more or less fairly acquired, as the colonial project reduced to baubles the living heritage of the oppressed. The River Lee has begun the process of decolonization. In this, it is led by its curator of material culture, Dr. Alice James. Alice believes in repatriating sacred objects and reinterpreting those which might reasonably be held outside the communities within which they originate, a task she undertakes in partnership with said communities. Moreover, Alice believes that the status quo must be challenged in the museum sector, structures rethought. Until people from originating communities are actually working in museums permanently, and for the long term, there will never be true institutional change. Alice does not enjoy the full support of her colleagues. Malcolm, the director, has apparently photographic recall of policy statements and can be relied upon to cite the position of the most useful professional association at the drop of a hat. Repatriation is a complex issue involving a range of emotional, ethical, legal and political factors, he parrots with an earnest smile. Malcolm is currently stalling on the removal or reinterpretation of human remains in the collection. Among some 500 plus holdings are a shrunken head from the Aquar people in Ecuador, a mummified Egyptian woman, and a range of skeletal remains from across the globe. Malcolm cites a recent survey to the effect that only 9% of people oppose the display of human bones in museums. This, he says, supports his own belief that the educational benefits of learning from human remains outweigh the rights of the dead. Display of human remains can greatly stimulate empathy, he argues, allowing a much stronger connection to the culture that is being represented. Alice believes that the display in the River Lee more often suggests human beings from other cultures to be savage, primitive or gruesome. For now, though, she chooses to focus on her own scheme of redress and repatriation and tackle Malcolm again at a later date. And so the woman's finger bone remains on show in its case, beside its discredited reliquary, unchampioned by Alice or anyone else. It was carbon dated during some previous period of plentiful funding and identified as early modern. Had Alice thought about that and the crushing injury to the finger, the little digit might have sparked a line of thought as to the hypocrisy of cultures that view others as savage. It might even have led to the finger being reunited with the rest of its body, or at least what is left of it. But Alice must choose her battles. And so she does. And children continue to peer into the case and say yuck and shudder, then laugh and run on to look at the headman's axe and the penis of a whale.
I think
we were really interested in the way that you structured the story. It ends with Lilias's perspective herself and her story from her point of view, but there's a lot of different stages that it goes through before that and different characters, different people, and it sort of focuses on that journey in a way of her remains and in particular her finger bone. What made you structure it in that way?
I think there's maybe two parts to the answer. And one is that when in writing about Scotland's witches, there's a real challenge. I mean, there's obviously lots of challenge. It's really upsetting stuff. It can be quite overwhelming. But actually, it's also quite samey. Because, you know, these were fabricated charges. They were fabricated to a pattern. Everyone knew what witches got up to. So that's what every witch was accused of. And it pretty much followed the same pattern. And so there's a kind of challenge for a writer, which is what am I going to do that's different every time? And because of that oddity that Lilias's remains were dug up and exhibited and owned by antiquarians and various people through their history, I thought, well, isn't it interesting to think about how we still view witches and how we viewed witches through time? How quickly did we as a country, obviously they in the far distant past, suddenly realise that they'd done a great, great wrong? And very quietly overturn the legislation. And in a sense then, how did the perception of a witch change through time? So the way that I structured the story, it sort of begins in a museum where this finger bone is unlabeled and no one knows what it is. But they're busy thinking about the ways that we present the past because decolonization in museums is such an important subject. So they're thinking about how we hold human artifacts, human bones. And then it moves back sort of through the people who've owned it. And I was thinking about all the motivations from ghoulishness to genuine superstition to just the sort of abuses of power that allow people to sort of collect things that pertain to other people. I mean, they're actual bones. It's quite an alarming and disturbing thought. And I find it fascinating because obviously at the time, the authorities who had to deal with Lilias didn't know what to do with her and had to come up with a solution. But actually, they were right in a sense. They got rid of those remains because those remains then did exert a sort of a fascination. Not the one they thought, wasn't the devil bringing her back to life. But people are drawn to those kind of things in the same way, perhaps, as, you know, they take down a Cromwell Street where the Wests carried out their murders because it draws ghoulish visitors. And I just find that such a fascinating idea, married then also to the idea of how we do or don't commemorate Scotland's witches.
Yeah, and what strikes me is the respect or disrespect, depending on which character in the story you're kind of reading, they have for Lilias and her remains.
And some of them don't even know that they've got Lilias's remains. No. Someone stuffs a finger in his pocket and runs away and has no idea what he's got. So yeah, and there's a point at which the remains are even dressed up as something else. They're sold as a holy relic, or at least there's an attempted sale. And I'm kind of fascinated by all that human collecting behaviour. And so I had a lot of fun with it. And that sounds an awful thing to say because the section where we meet Lilias herself was very much not fun. But, you know, I think she was a really impressive woman. She didn't give her interrogators a single new name. She only named women who were already dead or who had already been charged. So nobody who was not already caught up in it suffered as a result of what Lilias said. And you think, you know, she did die while she was imprisoned. I wonder if she died under interrogation.
The Collector. Oxley Hope fancies himself an intellectual, and at first he is delighted by the invitation to join Thorne and the others in what they rather grandly style an invisible college. He has visions of evenings in the library debating Boole's latest paper on logic, or Ruskin's theories of architecture with like-minded gentlemen. In fact, the club has little in common with those 17th century groupings from which it takes its name, unless the aim of the alchemists and intelligencers of old was to pass around dirty pictures and exchange tips on horses. Oxley Hope is interested in neither, but these are his neighbours, and there is little other society here to speak of, and so he continues to have Thompson lay out his evening dress on the last Thursday of each month and have the coach readied for the drive to whichever great house is hosting them on this occasion. Tonight, when he is shown into Thorne's library, He is surprised to see the room has been transformed into something more akin to the place of study he had first imagined. The great table is set with an odd collection of objects. Wood, bones, dark piles of what might once have been fabric. More wood is strewn upon the floor.
"Oxley Hope!" bellows Thorn, his face flushed with brandy. "Meet Peyton, painter, you know."
The painter is a young man, curly-haired, serious of countenance. He bows. Oxley Hope is suddenly shy. He nods curtly and walks over to the table.
"What's all this, then?" he asks.
"The bones of a witch," the painter says. "At least a woman accused of witchcraft. Some local lads dug her up, and they brought her to me." "Why?" Oxley Hope asks. He can't see the link with painting. "I'm known to have an interest in such things," the painter says. "Well, in tales and songs, and the history folk in these parts tell each other." There is a guffaw from the other side of the room. Oxley Hope looks over and sees Rogerson miming something unspeakable with the woman's skull, while Thorn and Laidlaw cheer him on. Peyton pretends not to notice. Oxley Hope does his best to block the view as he turns back to the table. "How did she die?" he asks. "When?" "Just after the turn of the 18th century," Peyton says. "It's hard to say how. She wasn't put to death. If she had been, the body would have been burned. She supposedly died under interrogation. She was a good age, and they must have tortured her. See, one of the fingers is broken. I'm looking in the Kirk Session papers, but I haven't found anything yet. They dealt with the witchcraft locally, you see, the local minister and the landlord, the important men in the community." Just then, Thorn comes over.
"What do you reckon, old chap?"
he says, clapping Oxley Hope on the shoulder.
"Peyton's gonna give me part of the coffin to make a walking stick. Who knows, a rap with that might bewitch that Arabian of mine into finally winning something. Ha ha ha!"
He chortles at his own wit.
"You should buy a piece of it too," he says, when he has recovered. "Peyton'll see you right. Here."
He picks up the broken finger bone and puts it into Oxley Hope's waistcoat pocket so the tip of the digit sticks out.
"Capital!" he roars.
He claps Oxley Hope again a couple of times on the back and wanders over to rejoin the others. Oxley Hope stirs the piles of fabric on the table with his own stick. It is filthy with age and whatever unthinkable substances have leached into it. But it is clear enough that it was always poor, a rough homespun. "This is just some village wretch," he says to Peyton. "How could they have convinced themselves that poor old women were in league with the devil?" Peyton pauses for a second before he answers. "I don't think they ever believed it," he says. "But they were rich and they had power and they wanted to stay rich and keep that power. And to do that, well, they had to keep the poor in fear, in case they took it into their heads to ask what gives one man the right to rule over another, regardless of skill or talent or superiority of mind." He glances over at Thorn for a moment, and then turns his cool gaze back to Oxley Hope. Oxley Hope feels his cheeks flush red. "How much for the finger bone?" he asks. "Keep it," says Peyton. "A gift to remember this evening by."
Thank you, says Oxley Hope, awkwardly.
He is uncomfortable now in the painter's company. He gives a nod and walks over to join Thorn and the others, glad for once to talk of hunting and horses.
I was interested in why you guys wanted to begin with Lilias.
Maybe it's because there's more of an idea of Lilias. Like you said, there was that reconstruction of her face. that felt like, because of the way that her memory was preserved in that specific way that was really unusual, I suppose maybe we felt kind of closer to her in our minds as a character and felt almost like she kind of summed up a lot of the ideas around the project. And there was, yeah, a real almost personal connection, it felt like. That's kind of how I felt. What about you, Lauren?
I think so. And I think that idea of her grave being in that liminal space, we talked about that a lot in terms of, I suppose, our artistic approach to the project and how we would go about approaching something where we decided from the get-go we weren't going to write songs about these women's lives, you know, in terms of having very literal words and very literal musical associations. But we wanted to create something that, I suppose, had an overarching sense of this idea of humanising these people. This liminal space kept coming back in a lot of our reading. And I suppose this idea of us being two individuals and having this kind of duality within our music and our writing and things not always just being as literal as one very obvious thing. But when we decided to start in the studio recording Lilius, we actually knew very little about how it was going to end up. We went into that recording week, certainly on my part, the least prepared we'd ever been. Is that fair to say,
yeah,
Rachel?
Yeah.
In a musical sense, if we had all these fragments of ideas, and obviously we'd been working remotely a lot, we had your stories, we had the research that we'd done, we had all this kind of discussion and constant dialogue about what we wanted the music to maybe sound like. But until we actually got in that studio space and had the ability to make sounds and to try things out, we didn't know what the overall sound was that we were wanting to create. But it felt like, because your story had all these layers and different aspects to it, that we wanted to layer up this track in a way where it was maybe perhaps the biggest thing on the album. And then we took our sound for the rest of the album from, felt like everything came from Lilius, really.
Yeah.
We spent a good couple of days really building on the first little bit of dialogue that you had for it, Rachel. In terms of Lilius, she's one of the women that we know more about than so many others. And how do you strike that balance when you're writing a story in what is essentially a fiction about somebody? How do you get that balance of historical fact that you are aware of and then imagining this life for somebody? How do you even go about approaching that?
I think that's a brilliant question. And I think it's fascinating to think that we know a lot relatively about Lilius, but actually we still know almost nothing. And it is, this is all happening. Lilius is later than, you know, the first persecutions are in the late 1500s, the first major persecutions. It's a very difficult time to imagine oneself into, mindset to imagine oneself into. So I think when I approached Lilius, it was just that last moment of aloneness, because they were alone. They were accused as individuals. I heard the writer Malcolm Gaskell, the historian Malcolm Gaskell, talk recently about, you know, the fact that society really believed it, and often there were kind of collective accusations. But actually, in the case of quite a lot of Scottish witches that we know of, this is one person suffering alone. And so it was that sort of last moment of Lilius's life that I thought, actually, how would you face that? And what sort of state would you be in?
The Witch. Lilius's pain has been worsening in the last hours. They broke her finger yesterday, and now she feels every heartbeat as a twin throb, red and black and hot in her hand, and silver and sharp under the bones of her breast. Now she has confessed, they have left her in the dark to sleep,
but the pain prevents her from taking her rest, even after all the long weeks of being wrenched awake, scarcely moments after her eyes could finally close. At least she has given them no further names. She's proud of her wit, telling them only of women long dead, and others she met while they were masked, like gentlewomen at a ball. They were frustrated, of course, the minister and the elders, but she gave them plenty else to keep their minds busy, the dirty sots. She made up a ceremony the devil used to make her his own, with a hand on her feet and another on her head. That made them boggle, for she is taller than most men in the village. She said he had carnal knowledge of her, wearing a straw hat, of all things. That detail came out in a delirium, and she had to work, not to laugh, with cold black skin and cloven hooves. She thought back to her girlhood and told them she danced with the devil in the moonlight at the barn rods at Martinmas. But all the others there were dead now, and that was the truth, for that dance was 50 years in the past, and not one who stood up there still living. She talks of women already burned as witches long syne, for nothing can harm them further now. Poor Grizzel Anderson, and Eufen Sturt, and the others. She did name Agnes Curry, but Agnes had been accused of witchcraft many times before, and has never paid any price for it. If she was a witch, Lilius wonders, would the devil help her now? Her life has had few comforts, and now it seems it will end at the hands of the hangman, who will squeeze the life from her before her body is burned and her ashes scattered to the wind. She hates the thought of that, dying under a man's hands, while everyone she knows on earth looks on and does nothing to aid her. But the hangman will be robbed of his victim this time. The pain is fanning out from Lilius's breast now, into her neck and her shoulder where it tightens like a vice. She can no longer feel the pain in her hand, and her lips are numb. Who knows whether God or the devil has listened? Lilius Ade's suffering is past.
Listening to the Heal and Harrow podcast, produced by us, Heal and Harrow, and recorded and edited by Grant Anderson. All the music you heard is from our self-titled album. With thanks to Mary Kidd and Gerda Stevenson.
You can buy our album, a copy of Mary's book We Are All Witches, and hear the stories in full by visiting healandharrow.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Bye for now.